But this morning, Lord, I guess it could relate to Will's. It's about families, and it's about inheritance, and it's about land, and it's about sons, and good sons, and bad sons, and good fathers, and maybe not so wise fathers. And it's a wonderful story. And Jesus was well known for telling stories, and telling really good stories. Parables, we refer to them as. And stories are wonderful things. Stories can help keep people alive long after they've gone. There are stories of my father's father, a man that I didn't know, who had many wonderful sayings, including a gem like, "What you don't know won't make your head ache." Or, when used in reference to his son, he would say, "What he don't know won't make his head ache," to try to reassure my mom not to worry about things too much. Stories can serve to educate. So it might be something you could learn from someone else's mistakes, or our own misspent youth, or moments where we failed. It could be a warning, or an admonishment, or an encouragement. Stories can surprise and entertain us, sometimes with a lesson. And Jesus told these parables to entertain and to surprise listeners, to help open their eyes to new ideas, or to help them think about a common situation in a new way. And today's story is one of those surprise-filled stories. But we don't seem to be very surprised by it when we hear it. There was once a man who had two sons. No wasting time setting the stage. Oh, two kids. Right to the fun part. One of the sons says, "Father, I want my share of the inheritance right now." Okay, that's the moment where you guys were supposed to gasp. That was one of the surprise pieces in this story. These are the kinds of things that just weren't done. This son has essentially said, "Dad, I really wish you were dead, because I want my inheritance now." An inheritance is passed on at death in Jesus' time. And second, by wanting his inheritance now, which is land, he's told his father that land that's been in this family probably for generations upon generations. It's the foundation of who they are, where they come from. It doesn't matter. "Whatever, Dad, just sell it. And can I have cash, please? Small bills. Stores have problems with hundreds." But in agrarian society, in Jesus' society, land was everything. Land was passed down. Land was valued. Your job, while you looked after the land, was to maintain and perhaps even increase it before you gave it to your children. And their job was the same. You didn't leave or move around like we do. You put down roots. You knew your neighbors, and they knew you. They knew your family, where you came from. They knew your children for generations and generations. You depended on them, and they on you. So saying that the land doesn't matter, that it has no value, was mean and untrue, and the audience would have been shocked. So I want to try this again. The youngest son says, "Father, I want my share of the inheritance right now." That's much better. So what does dear old Dad do? Does he send this kid to his room until he's 47, put him in quarter time, send him out to hoe the weeds or maybe spank him? Nope. Dad divides his property. Jesus doesn't tell us if the father's frustrated or disappointed. We don't know if this was a surprising event or simply another jab at a long line from this youngest son. The father does what the son asks. He divides his property and gives half to the youngest son. The entire community would have known what was happening. No one would sell land unless you had to. It was valuable, part of your heritage. So when the for sale sign went up, the community would have wondered what was going on. Was the community surprised at this youngest son? Or were they perhaps disappointed, or perhaps saying, "Failures. He's like that." We don't know. So how are you feeling about Dad? Here's a father who's not receiving the respect he deserves as a patriarch. Here's a son that's running amok, and Dad doesn't really seem to be putting too many rules or instructions in place. No punishments that we see or hear about. Perhaps Dad never has. Perhaps the listeners are grateful that they do not have such a son. We know the rest of the story, and probably most of us could tell it off the cuff if we had to. The younger son goes to a distant land, runs through his money, and then there's a famine. Times got hard, he found work swapping pigs. He was so hungry, he was ready to eat the pig food. Okay, the listeners should have gasped a couple more times. This is a hard story, but it doesn't sound so bad to us. We might even know a couple modern tales of woe, of wayward children bringing pain and despair to families. Perhaps we were those kids. But imagine a good Jewish boy from a wealthy home heads off to a distant country. Distant country means not Jewish. Not Jewish means bad and unclean. Another gasp from the audience and shaking of heads. This good-for-nothing son has gone out to be with Gentiles, if you can imagine, and lost all of his money, all of the inheritance, to Gentiles. And if that's not bad enough, just when you think that this son is truly the worst that could be, he gets a job slopping pigs, of all creatures. Pigs, unclean animals. And he's actually ready to eat the pig food. A Jewish boy even thinking about eating pig food. Well, you should be shaking your head in horror and be grateful that you do not have such a child. This is bad stuff. Cover the ears of young children kind of stuff. But all is not lost, it seems. At least his selfishness has caught up with him. This boy is hungry, times are tough, and now there's no friends. No celebrations, no parties. You might be thinking, he's pretty much getting what he deserves. Treating his father and family so horribly. And so, he decides to head home. But he's not coming home as the long-lost son. He's hoping that Dad will hire him on as a servant. His hope, apparently, is to reach his father before the community steps up and intervenes. Before the community tries to keep him from his father. He has the confession ready. He's not really heading home out of love, and he's not going to pretend it. He's returning home out of hunger. He's returning home to apply for a job as a hired hand on what is left of the family farm. If he can earn enough to pay back what he's lost, well, perhaps he'll get by. He'll be the talk of the neighborhood again. He'll bring shame to his family again, and he'll disappoint those who love him again. But down the road he trudges nonetheless. He heads home rehearsing his confession. He's ready to take the initiative, and he's really hoping for lunch. Someone may have seen him coming and told his father, because the story says his father is on the lookout for him. But I wonder if his father has spent every day gazing down the road, looking for his son, wondering if today, perhaps, is at last the day that he will come home. His father sees him while he is still far off. And then Jesus astonishes the audience yet again. He says, while he was still a long way off, his father saw him, and who was filled with compassion, he ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. Dad runs. Dad runs. Dad runs so that everyone can see his pale ankles, so that his robe is wedged between his legs and flutters out behind him like a skirt. Dad runs like a mother instead of a father. He runs and he puts his arms around his son and he kisses him right there on the road, right where everyone can see them. You're supposed to gasp again. This was not done, period. Patriarchs did not run anywhere for any reason. Patriarchs did not welcome back thoughtless and selfish sons quite so easily. Patriarchs did not hug and kiss their children in public, and they certainly did not run, not ever. Prince William and Kate got married earlier this year. It was quite a formal affair, quite a very much steeped in tradition and hierarchy and protocol of who does what and when and how. So just imagine for a moment Queen Elizabeth doing cartwheels down the aisle. It would never happen. I don't know if she's able to do a cartwheel anymore, but even if she was, she simply wouldn't. It's not appropriate. And it's the same way. There's a protocol. There's an expected way for parents to treat children, especially patriarchs, to treat wayward children. And this guy was not doing it. This is not what folks were expecting. He should be sitting on a chair on the porch, relaxing, waiting for his son to approach him. Head down, thinking of ways to beg forgiveness. That's what ought to happen. But the son hardly has a chance to blurt out the words we're waiting for. We're waiting for him to apologize. He's been practicing this. And Jesus doesn't really give the impression that Dad's even listening. He says, but, Dad calls for the robe, the ring, the fatted calf, and some sandals. Get that calf! Throw it on the barbecue! Let's have a party! We're going to roast veal for the entire village. This man might have been ashamed of his son's behavior, the things that this family had been put through. And there isn't a whole lot in the son's behavior to make Dad proud. So you might expect that Dad would want his son to sort of lie low for a while. Maybe stay under the radar, if you will. Allow the son to express remorse, hear the stories and regret in private. But no, Dad pulls out all the stops and hosts a big old community celebration, not a quiet family dinner. It's a feast to restore the family's honor and a feast to restore the family's son. It's a banquet of reconciliation for anyone who will come. Come and see that my son who was lost, has come home. Come celebrate. This is an important event. And if there was ever a man who deserved a happy ending, this is probably him. And this is where we sometimes like to finish the story. It's a nice story if it ends here. Wayward son goes out, lives a wild life, sees the error of his ways, and comes back home to be reconciled. Begs father's forgiveness, dad's nice enough to throw a party, and they lived happily ever after. But that's not how Jesus ends the story. Jesus isn't quite done yet. The older son shows up. He hears the music and the dancing, and he refuses to go into the house. And again, you should be astonished. Even today in the Middle East, elder sons will stand barefoot at the doors of their father's homes to welcome their father's guests. But not this son. This son is angry. The elder son is the good son. He's done everything right. He's never caused a day of trouble. And he really doesn't feel like sitting down with his brother, who has cost the family half of the farm and has cost his father so much grief. So the elder son refuses to even come in the house. A terrible insult, right there in front of the community. And the only way for Dad to save the evening would be to stay right there at the table and pretend that his older son wasn't off being a jerk. Then, later on, once the guests have gone home, he can go outside and tell his oldest son a thing or two about how things are going to work around here. But you know that's not how Dad operates. Dad goes out to the good son the same way he went out to the bad son, but he doesn't run this time. He meets his oldest son in the yard, and the son lets Dad have it. Both barrels. Nothing held back. Look how many years I've stayed here. I've worked for you. I've given you never one moment of grief. You've never, ever thrown a party for me and my friends. This son of yours, this son who left, who's thrown away all of your money on wild living and who knows what, he comes back and you throw a party? What's up with this? The older son's problem is probably that nobody really asked him if he wants to be reconciled. Nobody asked him how he feels about spending what's left of the family's inheritance on three people instead of two. No one's asked him how he feels about being known as the brother of the good for nothing, or how he might even feel wearing the second best robe, because the best one's on his brother's back. The father says, "Son, you don't understand. You're with me. Everything I have is yours. This is a wonderful time. This brother was dead and he's alive. He's lost and now he's found." And the forgiving and compassionate father is really the main character in Jesus' story. But we routinely make the story about the younger son and his supposed self-improvement. We can't really bear the thought of one so lowly and misbehaved receiving redemption without earning it somehow. And so we like to remember the parts of the story that sound as though he did. But we need to keep in mind that this parable is the third in the series of lost and found narratives. The first two are about a sheep and a coin. And neither of those did anything to merit being found or celebrated. The whole point of the three parables is the one who searches and the joy of finding that which is lost. Merit has nothing to do with it. These are parables of grace. And grace really messes with our notion of how the world ought to work. It seems unfair. We've grown up learning that you get what you earn. If you work hard, you will be rewarded. If you behave yourself, you can be relied on, you'll be responsible, people will think well of you. If you don't work, if you're unreliable, you will suffer. It's how the world works. And this unmerited system of substandard behavior is a threat. But isn't that what Jesus came to do? To threaten the whole system? This is the one who said, the last shall be first, and the first shall be last. This is the one who, just prior to telling three parables about grace, sits down to eat with tax collectors and sinners. Before Jesus ever opened his mouth to teach his followers about grace, he preached a whole sermon simply by sitting at a table. And if we set aside our focus on the younger brother, the powerful message of grace becomes clear. This isn't exactly easy for us to do because it puts us in a position of having to accept that unmerited favor is bestowed on someone who doesn't deserve it. It's unfair that this father treats him so lovingly, so generously, and so compassionately. It's not right that he should be rewarded so lavishly when he's done something so despicable. We're left protesting that he didn't earn it. He doesn't deserve it. The hard, loyal workers, the people like us, should be rewarded. We're left hanging out in the yard, aren't we? We have our own set of standards and expectations about appropriate behavior. We've developed these concepts of right and wrong from the time we're quite young. They come from a variety of places. It could be family, experiences, culture, and our own personalities. And because of this, it's sometimes hard to watch others make choices that violate our standards. We understand fair and unfair. Just ask any father and mother. Any young child understands fair and unfair. I have a 2-year-old nephew. He doesn't necessarily have all the words to express how he feels, but he will really let you know that it's not fair if someone has ice cream and he does not. You will definitely know how he feels. He understands fair. And if this was something only children and teenagers didn't understand, well, we'd be off the hook. But it isn't. We cry foul or unfair all the time. Our society is very much attuned to fairness. There are all kinds of things that happen in life where some get the long end of the stick and some get the short end. It's simply not fair. And sometimes we silently and sometimes loudly protest when someone seems to receive something that they haven't earned, or worse yet, don't even deserve. More importantly, we sometimes make God's blessings of love, forgiveness, and salvation about what we've done to earn them, instead of accepting that it's God's free decision to give these gifts as he chooses, even to unrepentant sinners. How mistakenly do we emphasize our standing as repentant sinners, all of us, prodigal sons and daughters, instead of emphasizing the gracious forgiveness, love, and grace of the Father, who simply welcomes all of us in, welcomes all of us into the party. And it's not surprising that the Father in the story is representative of God, but what can be surprising is the way that God deals with these two sons. God is not concerned about keeping things equal or fair or about keeping everyone happy with how things are. God is concerned about giving both parties what they need, when they need it, and wants to make sure that relationships are restored. So even though the youngest son has rejected God by going off into the world and living foolishly, and even though the oldest son has rejected God by failing to see all of the good things in his life, God is still there, waiting to welcome both of them back. The youngest son was welcomed with open arms and given a large party. And maybe his father felt that he needed it, and that the community needed it. You've been through a great deal. You've learned your lesson. You need grace and acceptance, so let's celebrate. The oldest son needed a change of attitude more than a celebration. While the youngest son was out making a fool of himself, you have been here with enough to eat. You've been enjoying everything I could give you, including my love. And nobody said that you weren't welcome at the party. In the same way that God loved both his sons and wanted to give them all that he could give, God loves us and wants us to experience joy and fulfillment in our own lives. The generosity of God is not found in receiving an easy life. nor is it found in getting what we want. But rather, God's generosity can be found in how we choose to look at things. We don't know what lies ahead, and we will probably have both good and bad moments in our lives. And in addition to uncertainties of life, our choices may carry with them either good or bad consequences. But regardless of what happens, God has promised to always walk with us and wants to walk with us on this journey of life. So generous is God that God is always willing to meet us, regardless of where we are, where we may have been, or where we may be going. And it doesn't matter what perspective we have while on this journey. This isn't a story about repentance. It's not really about doing something to atone for wrongdoings. The story really isn't about us. The story is about the one who atoned for us, the one who died for us, while we were still sinners. The one who rushes out to welcome us home with open arms and rejoices every time he finds us, regardless of where or how or when we finally arrive. This is grace, God's love-filled, generous grace. So come on in and join the party where we all are welcomed.